So, good morning, everyone. My name is Felix Lindner, better known as FX. And first of all, I would like to thank you all for actually getting up that early. I assume pretty much everyone went out partying last night. I certainly did. And so I'm here to talk a little bit about Cisco IRS Forensics. I assume some of you have seen the two IRS-centric talks yesterday, and essentially this talk is about how to detect mischief that the other gentleman presented, and to show you that even on a platform that never had anything like this before, we can actually create forensics tools and detect compromises. But first, I'm doing that for quite a while. I have quite some record in attack and defense on network side and network equipment side. And I do keep getting the same questions, namely, why would you actually care? So if you're familiar with the subject, please bear with me. For those of you who still have those questions, I have some introduction slides. Then I'm going to talk about the types of attacks that we're looking at in with network equipment in general, like what are people actually doing? And we're actually comparing them a little bit to what type of evidences do we actually get? And how do we see what people actually do? And then we go into the binary evidence analysis, what happens when people really take over a router and do a reality check on Cisco IOS exploitation. And I have absolutely no idea what the other screen is showing. So, first of all, why is this talk Cisco-centric? 92% market share of routers that cost more than $1,500. That is essentially the answer. Pretty much everything out there is Cisco. However, I keep hearing people saying, why don't you like research Juniper? Honestly, for attack and defense, Juniper is just a fairly broken and modified FreeBSD. So there is very little value in going into the details of hacking FreeBSD, even if it is in a very expensive enclosure. The same holds true for your arbitrary cheap home router that runs Linux, because it is, at the end of the day, just Linux. So the methods that we have, both in attack and forensics, are applicable for Linux and embedded devices as they are on hosts. So this is why this talk is Cisco-centric. Why do we actually care about network equipment forensics? By the very definition, the goal of computer forensics is to explain the current state of a digital artifact. That means we need acquisition of evidence, recovering information from evidence, and analysis of the information. For common operating systems, we do actually know how to do that. There have been methods around since people broke into computers. For network equipment, we're pretty much at a loss. It is very hard to tell, even for the most skilled CCIE, if a router crashed because it just felt like crashing, and believe me, Cisco IOS really very often just feels like crashing, or if someone actually tried to exploit a buffer overflow on the router. It is really, really hard to tell. And the question, of course, is not why should we look at it. The question is, if someone actually managed to get access onto the router with a remote exploit, do we want to know? Now, that is the most common question I get. They go like, well, you know what, you're talking about this stuff and it's really amazing and it's really fun and interesting, but in reality, who's going to hack routers? To understand the value of that is very simple once you realize that when you hack a machine, like a common operating system server, for example, you have access to that one machine. It might be administrator or kernel access, but you have access to that one machine. If you have an important machine, you have access to a couple machines that trust this machine. This couple can be quite large. depending on how important the machine was that you hacked into. But on the other hand, if you hack a very limited, small workgroup switch, you have control over all the traffic that every single machine connected to that workgroup switch receives and sends. If you hack the router that the workgroup switch is connected to, you actually have control over the entire network. People like fancy pictures. I do too. So here's the introduction network picture. You probably have seen that in many situations when people try to explain OpenText to you. So this is it. If you hack that one machine, you're not getting anywhere nowadays. Halfway decent switches, even like $50 switches, will prevent you from playing op games. The switch separates the hosts from each other. You're pretty much at the same position as you were before in relation to the other hosts that you're trying to attack. However, if you take the switch, then the separation is broken. You can modify any traffic, and it is really hard for the people behind the switch to even know that something is going on, because there is just no reverse network access control. There is no method for your host to find out if the network is broken or not. And of course, if you take the router, you have the added privilege of impersonating the entire network to the internet, as we have here in a very simple example. Now, on a larger scale, things get really complicated. So I would love to explain that on the larger scale of the internet, but as you see, it's just way too many routers. So let's go one down. This is a very regular picture of how networks can look like. Raise your hand if you know what a routing autonomous system is. Well, at least I have some people here that know that. Very good. So here we see server autonomous systems. And to the top right, we have the international ASCII representation of an asshole who is trying to participate in that network configuration. And everything else is just your regular government, internet, whatever. Now, the thing is, by design, our networks are very core-centric. So on those borders, we do have IDS, firewalls, IPS, idiots, and whatever your current favorite protection mechanism is. But then, even between the autonomous systems, we still have protections. The routers in blue here actually do ingress filtering, egress filtering, so they actually decide what routes are going to be propagated in both directions. They have access lists. They do anti-spoofing. They make sure that a connected network is not going havoc into the other networks. In the core, however, we have to have full trust. There is just no other way for IP to work. The nodes have to trust each other, otherwise we cannot dynamically route. That, of course, means on a more abstract level, the network is hierarchical and the network security is as well. Defending against your downstream is a very common thing. Like, every single ISP knows how to do that, because otherwise every single ISP will take routing advertisements from their DSL customers, which they well don't. Defending against your upstream, however, is rather hard. If your upstream tells you the routing changed, you have two choices: accept this new information or be disconnected. Defending against your peers in the core is very rare. Even tier one ISPs don't actually do that, simply because it's hard enough to keep that network alive anyway. They don't have any protection against each other because they're happy if the thing actually works. If you control anything in this hierarchy, you control everything below it. That is the nature of the beast. So in pretty pictures, if our little guy upright controls one of the gray routers in his network, he is controlling route distribution in in the enhanced IGRP3 zone. However, if he just controls another router, he controls the entire network you're looking at. Even the guy to the right and even the guys to the left bottom. Now, the common argument is, but we have dollar secure protocol, whatever, SSL, IPsec, whatever your favorite protection here is. Those protocols are really important and they're really good at what they do. They do guarantee that nobody modifies your traffic. They do guarantee that nobody spoofed the message, and they do guarantee that it's not replayed if it's halfway a decent protocol. But if someone is sitting in the network and does exactly any of the above, what do you do? The only thing they can tell you is someone tampered with the protocol, someone tampered with this message, it is no longer integer, it is no longer valid. But your choice is availability or security. Your choice is keep communicating over the obviously owned network or shut up. At some point in time, availability becomes more important. If you're just disconnected, at some point in time, you have to get communication out, even over the compromised network. And, well, think about your boss and your mom. Once home banking doesn't work for about a week because it keeps complaining about broken SSL, they might actually get off their asses and like walk to the bank and make the transactions manually. But the way more likely case is that they just accept the fact that the encryption is broken and get over it. So we don't actually have anything to prevent people taking over our networks and then keep communicating good. Because if the user called, say in this scenario, if the user called say, please do not route my packets over this compromised router, it would be called source routing. And there is a very, very good reason that this IP feature is disabled in the entire internet. Because that would mean an individual user will have control over the network and over the network flows. And that is exactly what we want to prevent. So, this is by design. Welcome to the world of IP. IP is designed with the idea of having a network with intelligence nodes in the middle and dump end users and dump end devices. That is the absolute nature of the network. Therefore, we should actually care if someone compromised our routers. So what types of attacks are we looking at against routers? Principally, we have three things. We have protocol-based attacks, which are really old. We have functional-based attacks, and we have binary exploitation. Now, protocol-based attacks essentially go around the fact that someone injects control messages into the network, commonly referred to as routing protocol attacks. The attacker just becomes part of the network and influences how messages are forwarded. Typical examples are poisoning. DNS poisoning is actually a protocol-based attack. Interior routing protocol injections, like you have an OSPF area that you just participate, you become a neighbor, you inject new routes into the area, and routing is going to be different. Even external interior routing protocol hijacks are protocol-based attacks. Like in BGP, if you announce a more specific prefix, you will actually get it, and you will actually route that traffic. Then we have functionality-based attacks, and by that I mean primarily configuration issues. I was told that I shouldn't say fuck-ups. So weak passwords are still a really, really big thing in routers, because even in the CCIE labs, in the highest certification Cisco has for Cisco engineers, the passwords are all the same. So they get trained over 2 years to use the password Cisco. And they remember. And they remember afterwards, because it becomes an automatism. And then we have weak SNMP communities that, you know, have the same name as the router or something. Excuse me. And we have people posting their entire router config on the internet asking for help, which is a way to get owned. Then we have vulnerabilities in access checks. The famous Cisco HTTP level 16 and beyond vulnerability is still around. About 6 years after the vulnerability came out, we still see people scanning for that all the time. And, you know, attackers might sometimes be stupid and dumb, but if they scan for something 6 years later, they do expect to find something, and their experience is usually better than yours. Now raise your hand if you noticed the SNMP v3 HMAC vulnerability this year. That's fewer people. So it is, for me, it's the greatest vulnerability this year, despite that, because it is just so simple and it gives you straight access. Now, SNMP v3 is what everyone preaches to your network people when they start to get into security, because networks are managed by SNMP. Now, SNMP is inherently insecure because it only carries a community, a password, in clear text that authenticates the control to the agent, to the router. SNMP v3 was primarily invented to overcome the security issue and actually use real crypto. But because it was invented by the same people that would use ASN1 encoding in protocols just to make them a few bytes smaller and make sure that the router is exploitable forever, because nobody can implement that crap correctly, the same people figured that, well, cryptographically, we use, well, what they do, they use an HMAC, right? They use a hash over some secret. And cryptographically, the entropy of the entire hash has to be equal over all the bytes and all the bits. Now, that also cryptographically means that if I use a shortened hash, it is still as secure as the longer hash. Theoretically, that is correct, but only in theory are theory and practice the same. In practice, they're not. So they figured, okay, we save a few bytes in this SNMP packet for authentication, and we allow a shortened hash to be transmitted. They didn't specify how to implement that, so the implementation actually goes and says, well, I take my hash, and I take the hash from the packet, and I compare them as much as I had hash in the packet. Which, of course, is really convenient for the attacker, because what if the hash in a packet is one byte? You have 256 possible solutions. One of them is going to be correct. So that means with 256 packets, you can get onto any router on the internet that accepts your SNMP messages. Administratively, mind you. This is a very powerful vulnerability. And as a side note, all the lawful intercept functionality that is built into our routers today is SNMP v3 based. I'd leave it up to you as a home exercise to become your legal entity of the day. We also have the issue of Debianized SSH keys, obviously, on routers. So this is how people get onto routers with functionality attacks. There is another class of vulnerabilities in the functionality issues. There are denial of service vulnerabilities that I call queuing bugs. They are inherent to the less than optimal software design of Cisco IOS and its way to handle packets. If the software finds a packet in the incoming message queue, it will check if it can handle it or not. Now, if nothing on this router feels like it can handle this packet, the packet stays in the queue. And this queue, at some point, is going to be full. So we did have a bunch of those vulnerabilities in the past, and we're going to have some more in the future. There are denial of service vulnerabilities, but hey, denial of service on an internet core means your porn stops working. And that is bad. And then we have binary exploitation. Despite common belief, Mike Lynn was not the only one implementing one. And there are actually some public exploits out there. We have vulnerabilities against the router services, mostly, as you see, TFTP, HTTP, FTP. And we have vulnerabilities of the router protocols, namely OSPF, IPv6. There are a bunch of more, but those actually have published exploits. Michael's exploit is not published, but the other ones are. So now we know what attacks we have. Let's look at the detection. Topmost, SNMP. Do you have a deja vu from two slides back? This is the exact protocol that we use for monitoring our routers. And SNMP by itself is a polling mechanism. So it polls the router all the time and tries to find out what the current state is. It is built for network engineers. So it will tell you in painful and gory detail how the routing tables, switch tables, ARP tables, performance values, and whatnot look like. It is not going to tell you how many processes the router runs right now and how many open ports it has. So it is of limited value for finding out if the router actually got owned. We have syslog. It's not really used in larger networks, but in access layer networks, we do use syslog. It pushes out freeform strings. I'm pretty sure everyone has seen that. We have configuration polling. There is a fairly well-known tool called Rancid that people use for polling configurations and comparing them to a known state. We have route monitoring and looking glasses, which are actually routers set up or boxes set up that participate in the routing protocol. And their whole purpose is only to show if something changed in an unexpected way, like one of your nodes, like the leaf nodes in your network, suddenly becomes the default gateway to the internet. And we have traffic accounting. Traffic accounting turns out to be a very valuable source for forensics, for router forensics. Why? Because that's pretty much the only place in your network where people actually care to not lose their logging information because they get paid for it. This is the only place where they really care about having decent information, who sent what traffic when. So traffic accounting information is actually pretty useful. However, it doesn't have any content of what the people actually sent. Steve, could you turn your shirt down? Like, it's loud. So let's compare those monitoring mechanisms that we have today to what can we detect with them. As you see here in this matrix, we're actually doing pretty good when it comes to poisoning attacks and routing protocol attacks and stuff. Even illegal access due to config issues or access check vulnerabilities can be seen to an extent if you have like Nazi logging all over the place. However, if your router gets binary exploited, there's very little you can see, except for very, very stupid attackers that then fuck around with your configuration and write it back to NVRAM. So this is what I started to care about. I started to care about that because I started to be no longer the only one that wrote exploits for iOS. And I realized, well, what if someone actually writes an exploit that goes into wild and actually works decently compared to mine? We can't really know, and we want to see that. So what would a binary exploit actually do? There was a talk yesterday, but it was, let's say, incomplete on the topic. So the binary modification of the runtime image is, of course, the preferred method after you attack the router successfully and exploited it. So you patch user access credential checking. That's what the core guys did, and they did a pretty good job with that. You will patch logging mechanisms. Nobody thinks about that, but well, why wouldn't you do that? And of course, you would patch away those annoying ACLs. Because they're just getting in the way. Because at the end of the day, you want to control the network. You might want to explicitly tunnel out single packets and modify them or sniff them. You will have a span port or a GRE tunnel somewhere. You don't want ACLs to get in your way. you will patch data structures in general, like VTY access levels. You will bind additional VTYs. You will terminate processes. You will pretty much do what you do with an owned Unix box. You will also change the runtime configuration in a non-obvious way. That is actually possible, so you can actually change the configuration without the configuration change being visible in multiple ways. But if you have binary control over iOS, you can most definitely do that. You will change settings in some state machines, make SNMP show a static or slightly modified version, pretty much like when someone hacks CCTV in action movies and they keep showing the same loop of an empty room and then they go into this room and have a sex party or something. This is what you would do to SNMP. So it will just like slowly change a few values, but actually it wouldn't reflect the router state anymore. You will also possibly just load TCL backdoors. Later iOS versions do support Tickle, and the scripts can actually bind to TCP boards. There is, in older iOS versions, or not that older iOS versions, I think it's 12.3 and early 12.4, you can actually bind TCL scripts that survive the VTY termination. So you will still have access to the router remotely, and it's like your backdoor is actually just a very short script. It is widely used by people that get fired from ISPs. So for the forensics, for the binary exploit class, what do we need? We need, as I said in the introduction, evidence acquisition. We need recovering of the raw data and then recover information from the raw data. And we need analysis of the information afterwards. Plus, it wouldn't hurt if we actually understood Cisco IOS internals. So let's look at what memories do we actually have in a Cisco IOS device. We do. Those devices do start from something that's called Raman. It's pretty much like your BIOS on a PC. And Raman actually loads iOS image from flash or from the network, which is not the secure way to do it, into RAM. The image may be self-decompressing. The other talks yesterday mentioned that in more detail, but images don't have to be self-decompressing. They can be. The image may, and for bigger boxes, will contain additional firmware. It will contain the firmware for like the E1 boards, for ISDN controllers, for all kinds of crap. Then the configuration is loaded as an ASCII text from NVRAM or network, and it is parsed on load. So it can actually have like wrong entries and stuff. And it is mixed with the image-dependent defaults of the configuration settings. Most people are not aware of that. It actually, the same configuration of two different routers, the exact same configuration, will have a different meaning if those two different routers run a different iOS version. In general, everything is kept in RAM. Configuration changes have immediate effect and have to be manually written back into NVRAM. That leaves us with very little non-volatile evidence. On a common operating system, most evidence is non-volatile. You actually do care if the box was shut down or not. But if the box was shut down, imaging the hard drive and searching the hard drive with today's forensics tools will get you owned if you run Encase, but will actually give you enough information to prosecute the attacker and find out if there was an attacker in the first place. You would like to have non-volatile information, but it's optional. However, on iOS, all evidence is volatile. We need memory imaging to actually have any evidence whatsoever. And the problem is, as I already mentioned, the device defaults on restarting when it has some problems, when it detects invalid state internally. So restarting is the default behavior. Now, with all the evidence in RAM, that means all your evidence is gone. We have non-volatile evidence on Cisco. We have the flash file system that contains the image. So if someone from core actually played with your image and infected it, you will find it on the flash. And you will have an easy time in IDA finding out what they did. The NVRAM actually contains configuration if it was written back. But both cases, as I said, are really rare for binary exploitation. Like when you get code execution on a Cisco, you don't do that because you get caught. So for evidence acquisition, we actually are in luck because the iOS engineers, the software engineers, have the exact same problem. So iOS can actually write complete memory images called core dumps onto the flash file system if it's large enough, which means if you spend enough money on it, or onto a remote network server, FTP, RCP, something. It is a complete memory dump. It contains the main memory, it contains I/O memory, PCI memory. It is a raw dump. It's perfect evidence. There is absolutely no information whatsoever added from iOS to the core dump. It is just raw dumped out. So the thing here is that evidence collection actually has to be configured beforehand. It doesn't dump core by default. It crashes by default a lot, but it doesn't dump core by default. So you actually have to configure crash dump writing. The good news is it doesn't affect performance. Like many things you do on iOS do affect performance in very weird ways. Core dumps actually don't affect performance except for the performance of your device rebooting, like how fast it reboots, because it takes some time to write the core. So you can actually configure all your iOS devices in the network to dump core onto a more or less central located FTP server, which minimizes your monitoring efforts. Because you're no longer sitting there and watching every single router and see if it rebooted or not. You just wait for core dumps to show up in your FTP directory. That is very convenient. And it preserves evidence. You don't have to call your one capable network guy in the middle of the night because your router rebooted and then he can't do shit anything in any way because it already rebooted and all the information is already gone. But you can wait until the morning when he comes to work and he actually had a coffee and he can look at the core dump. Question is, why didn't we use that before? Like, why is that not standard configuration in halfway secure networks? Well, the core dumps were useless, except for Cisco engineers and exploit writers. So what do we do with the core? We have to answer state questions about the core. So we need to know what was going on the router when the core was written. Oh, I forgot to mention, you can actually write cores in the middle of a router's lifetime. It doesn't have to die. You can actually go onto the console and say, write core, and it will write a snapshot of the current memory image and then keep running. Cisco says that it will actually stop working while it writes core, and I have not seen a single case of the router actually caring. So, of course, it takes some CPU cycles, but it actually keeps working and forwarding traffic. If you have a counter example, I would love to hear it. So anyway, with the core, we want to know what processes did handle what data, what packets potentially crashed the router, and where did data come from. So we need a core dump analyzer. And Cisco doesn't provide one. And I think it is actually, it would not really be useful to use a Cisco tool here because you want it 100% independent. You want something like a second opinion on the router state. So you don't want Cisco code and you don't want anything based on disassembled Cisco code. It must gradually recover abstraction. Like you have a raw dump, you need something to build on, something to actually work with. And it should not be like Encase, so it should not be exploitable itself. As you probably figured out by now, we developed such a tool. Otherwise, it wouldn't stand here. So analyzing core files. This is going to be quick because the other two talks yesterday covered this. So iOS essentially is a large ELF binary. It's essentially like a large statically linked Unix program loaded by Ramon. It directly runs on the CPU, no privilege separation. Yeah, that was all covered in other talks. We do have virtual memory mapping, actually, but very minimal. So we don't have inter-process protection. Because we don't actually have processes, that was not mentioned yesterday. The processes are no processes. The processes are rather like threads on a Unix system. Because there is no separation, the processes are just independent CPU contexts. And that, in my definition, is a threat and not a process. We have the run-to-completion multitasking, which we have to take care of when we look at the core. And we have system-wide data structures, which are really incredibly helpful for finding out what happened to the router, because we have one common heap. And we have very little abstraction around the data structures. So essentially, what you see is what you get. That is also a security problem in the iOS code, because they have no way to force abstraction. If a developer decides to write directly at some pointer plus offset minus some other pointer, he can totally do that. There is no compiler or anything else that's going to like beat him up and tell him not to do it. So we take this ELF binary as a memory blueprint for the core file, because we don't know what's in the core file, but we know that the ELF binary actually contains sections. So the image will serve as a memory layout blueprint. We wish it were as easy as it sounds. Once you start looking at multiple terabytes of iOS images, as we do, you realize that Cisco managed to find every single possible and a bunch of impossible ways to break images. And I'm not really good at time. So we use this known to be good image also to compare the segments that should be static, that shouldn't break. Like the code segment should be the same in the image and in the core. Read-only data segment, same image core. Those can be compared bytewise. And this gives us the most simple and most effective detection of rootkits we ever had. Because here is an example of Recurity Lab Sir, that's our tool, against Topos Dick. And no, his rootkit is really called Dick, so that was his choice, not mine. We just compare the sections, and here you see, we simply get out the virtual addresses where Topo put in his trampoline code. And I was about to show you that in IDA, but I'm running out of time. And we can just go to those addresses. Oh, let's do that, fuck it. So here we have IDA and we have a core file loaded. It's just pure code, we don't know anything. But when we go to the address, it already knows that. we have some code here, and we just press C, and out comes the trampoline code. And it only has a very short section of code that it parses. As you see in the navigation band on top, it has a very small spec that says that is blue. And this is actually IDA crashing. And this is actually the entire rootkit. And when you go here, you see those are the parsing functions that check like the passwords. And here is the password that was a version that Topo prepared for the PHNOTA conference. So very simple comparison, very effective. You right away get your rootkit out without much research. We can also reconstruct the heap. As I said, it's one large heap, so we got plenty of information in there. We reconstruct the entire heap. We can do tests that by far exceed the onboard tests of Cisco IIS. And we also see a bunch of stuff that Cisco should not have done. Like they extend their heap into the data segment out of the heap segment because someone figured that it would be cool to just like freeze some memory and put it into the heap data structures. So we are seeing that as well, unfortunately. As I said, we can do heap verifications. We find holes in the heap, which is invisible to iOS onboard checks. Holds in a heap are a very telltale signal that someone did heap exploitation. We can identify heap overflow footprints. We can map heap blocks to referencing processes. That is one thing our tool does. It spits out a graph of the process related to the heap blocks. And we can get a process list. So we get everything we need for regular post-mortem analysis, because now we know where the stack of every single process is. We know where the heap blocks are, where the data structures are, where pointers point to, where they should point to, and where they should not point to. We find TCL backdoors. This is still largely incomplete. We just dumped the TCL script chunks right now. I fear at some point in time I have to drink lots of beer and then write a TCL decompiler. We have other random applications which I'm just skipping. The one thing, because I mentioned the queuing bugs before, queuing bugs are really easy to see once you have the core dump analysis. Because it's pretty much like when someone comes out of a convenience store and he has, like, he tries to balance, like, 200 apples on his hands, this guy got problems. The same holds true for a process having 200 packets in his fingers. That will be the process that manages to not take the packets off the queues, and that is your vulnerability. And the packets are actually your attack. Speaking of packets, iOS packet forwarding memory is in the core dumps. On the shared memory routers, about 6% of the router's memory is dedicated to I/O memory. In real-world installations, that's a lot more. And hardware switch packets are in the PCI memory, all of which we have. The I/O memory buffers are ring buffers, which means newer packets are not necessarily overwriting older packets, because the ring buffers are by packet size. If your router forwards lots of large packet traffic and then a few small packets, those small packets stay in those ring buffers very, very long. And iOS really tries to not copy packets around in memory, because that eats performance. And so they stay there. So we can extract them, which is quite useful. So we can dump out packets and see into the router's past what traffic it actually forwarded, what traffic it received, and what traffic it sent. We're just writing them in PCAP files, and we could do a lot more of that. We're probably improving that functionality, but it actually is already quite useful in that way that you really see traffic going in and out. And besides, here you actually see broadcast traffic from a Windows machine right in the middle that was just received by the interface in a regular receive operation. The only thing we don't know is when the packet was received. They might have hidden that somewhere in the data structures, but frankly, most iOS installations I've seen don't even have a real time set. They're all thinking it's like 99 or 93. So what about crash info? Later iOS versions write text files called crash info that contains information what supposedly was the cause of the iOS crash. We did find in our own research, trying to beat our own forensics tool, that there are cases where you can exploit the router in a way that doesn't write cores anymore, at least not to the network. If you fuck it up completely in a way that it doesn't know how to speak IP, it has a very hard time dumping a core on FTP. I assume it will still be able to write it to flash, though. However, I don't have a machine that has enough flash to dump onto flash. So crash info correlation can be helpful, especially in those cases. However, the problem is that iOS thinks about what could be the cause of the crash. So in most cases, iOS actually blames a process called crash writer, which is the process that didn't exist before it crashed, because it's the process that gets started to write the crash info. So this information tends to be useless. So what's the state of the tool I'm talking about? Hackers like to go up on stage and talk about something and then say, yeah, we have a 0.0.1 alpha. It barely compiles on Spark macOS X. That is not the case. We actually completed this tool to a 1.0 release version. Since February 2008, We do have an online service where you can upload core files and get the results with the latest version of our software. That is all free. We will probably make a free rootkit detection version available if there is actually demand for it. And we have a professional version that does all the magic mumbo-jumbo with like exporting into PCAP and stuff. There is a large list of stuff we want to do in the future. Feel free to add. Challenges, and I want to go over that really quickly, but it is really important. So, we have seen all those attack talks on iOS. Every iOS image is compiled individually. Like, they change a lot. It is not like we have five different versions as of in Windows, or 50 different languages or something. We have over 100,000 iOS images currently in use in the wild, in production networks. Probably a lot more. Around 15,000 at any given time are supported by Cisco officially. And iOS is very rarely updated. This is a great headache for iOS forensics, but it's also a great headache for exploit writers. Think this, the entire code is in the image. So remotely, you have a 1 in 100,000 chance to guess the right iOS image, if you're conservative. Any exception caused in a router causes a restart, which is inherent to the monolithic architecture. But it is not good for exploit writers, because like rebooting routers are pretty much noticeable, even to stupid network admins, because the network just doesn't work anymore. Stacks are heap blocks, so the stack is not on a fixed address. And even those addresses vary in the same image. So far, all iOS exploits we have seen use fixed addresses that depend on the exact iOS image. That means the diversity, the sheer diversity of iOS images out there is similar to the protection, in quotes, that the source port randomization patch you apply to your DNS service recently provides you for DNS. Pretty much the same entropy. We do perform our own research in that area to make sure ready for the next generation. So it will most certainly not stay that way. But right now we're doing pretty good in terms of exploitation because people just don't get them stable. I'm just saying, let the arms race begin. I mean, we are prepared. There, like the next attacks that are going to be are rootkit patching, core dumping, writing. Of course, like the rootkit doesn't want the core dump to be written, which is A, noticeable, and B, defendable by GDB debug protocol attacks. So we use the undocumented GDB debug protocol and read the memory instead of using the core dump. Then they may patch the GDB debug stub as well. Then you actually have to walk up to the router, but you can still use Ramon and the non-public privilege mode of Ramon to actually get memory dumps. It takes a while, but you can do it. We did it. We will have data segment only backdooring, so that the backdoor is not in a text or read-only data segment, so it's not easily noticeable. So we will have to add data structure validation, which we will do anyway. And configuration changing and stuff. So I think we're pretty good once we get all those platforms finally covered, which is the large part of the work. This is what we spend most of the time on. So with that, I'm concluding almost on time. I hope you appreciate, despite the keynote speaker actually stealing like 15 minutes from me. We do constantly update our documentation publicly. We don't keep it private. We have everything in a wiki, which is together with the online service for core dump analysis at reachable at this address. And feel free to add requests or ask questions or stuff. That's what it is for. So we want to hear from you. Any questions?